Hello, welcome to Entertainment Weekly. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Every week I read from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. This week we have more movie and TV reviews, kind of than usual. I've got a must list, and as I'm recording this, we're pretty much into prom season, and they have an article that fits quite nicely with that. So let's get started. First, it's the must list, a new Final Destination, a Blaxploitation classic set, and Alexander Skarsgård in Murderbot top this week's must list. TV writer Alana Bennett's debut novel and Tim Miller's adult animated Netflix series round out our picks for the weekend. This is by the Entertainment Weekly staff. I've always been a fan of Natasha Lyonne, so I was thrilled that my Russian doll fix was quickly replaced by Poker Face. Then, we had to wait 2 years for season 2 of the Peacock series. Well, it's finally here, and if you want a taste of what's to come, check out our latest cover story, which dives into how the rest of the season will play out after that first 3-episode arc. That was Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief. The first movie is Final Destination Bloodlines. Death is finally back in theaters. After a 14-year break, the Final Destination franchise returns with another installment sure to inspire a host of new irrational fears. The sixth film in the series weaves a through line between the previous films as death arrives to torment the remaining descendants of a mass casualty catastrophe that never was, thanks to a last-second premonition. The Reaper won't be denied forever. Franchise veteran Tony Todd, who died in November, returns for the last time, reminding horror fans of what made the original films so memorable. Blaxploitation Classics, Volume 1. 6 Blaxploitation classics, including Pam Grier in Coffee and Sheba Baby, and Fred Williamson in Black Caesar, make their way to 4K for the first time in this box set, also featuring a new documentary on the genre. What's not to dig? Murderbot. Come for the Apple TV Plus adaptation of Martha Wells's best-selling science fiction book series. Stay for Alexander Skarsgård's deadpan, soap opera-loving sec unit. The show is a slow burn, but the payoff in the final episodes is worth the wait. Love, Death, and Robots, Volume 4. While the puppetized Red Hot Chili Peppers performance kicking off Season 4 is something of a departure, the animated shorts series vibe endures. The Netflix title from Tim Miller and David Fincher continues to stun with its delicious, bite-sized eye morsels. The Education of Kia Greer. The first novel from culture and TV writer Alana Bennett, who we know from XO, Kitty, is the swoony young adult romance we need. As the daughter of a reality TV star, Kia Greer craves normalcy. But being thrust into the spotlight leaves her to save both her relationship and her sense of self. That's our must list, a new Final Destination, a Blaxploitation Classics set, and Alexander Skarsgård in Murderbot top this week's must list. And it was by the Entertainment Weekly staff. So let's take a look at this review of Murderbot. Alexander Skarsgård's killer robot comedy is slow to boot up. Based on Martha Wells's Murderbot Diaries book series, the Apple TV Plus comedy follows a depressed robot that just wants to binge-watch TV. This is by Kristen Baldwin. Security Unit 238776431 is the property of the company, a powerful mega conglomerate located in the galaxy's Corporation Rim. Programmed to serve, the heavily armed robot soldier does not love its job. "I was built to obey humans," explains SecUnit, played by Alexander Skarsgård in the series premiere of Murderbot. But humans? Well, they're assholes. Unbeknownst to its owners, however, this SecUnit, a misanthropic robot in the vein of Marvin the Paranoid Android from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and Bender from Futurama, just hacked its quote-unquote governor module, freeing itself from techno-slavery. Though it could kill its human captors and set off on its own, SecUnit does not want to risk discovery as a rogue bot, which would result in being stripped for parts and melted in an acid bath. Choosing instead to bide its time, the SecUnit, which decides to rename itself Murderbot, reluctantly joins its next assignment, working for a team of researchers from Preservation Alliance, a distant planet that rejects the Corporation Rim's harsh laws and embraces an egalitarian form of government. Murderbot resigns itself to protecting these hippie scientists, though all it really wants to do is watch entertainment content downloaded from the company's satellite feed. Murderbot, adapted by Chris and Paul Weitz from About a Boy, from Martha Wells' popular book series, has a hilarious premise, an admirable cast, and a lavish Apple TV budget. It also has a real pacing problem. The first half of the 10-episode season is puzzlingly light on plot momentum and laughs. While the action, characters, and comedy do ultimately gel by the end, viewers will likely have to wait for season 2 to see Murderbot reach its killer potential. Preservation Alliance leader Dr. Ida Mensa, played by Noma Numizweni, and her team of scientists, Rothi, played by Akshay Khanna, Bardwaj, played by Tamara Podinsky, Gurthin, played by David Desmalchian, Arda, played by Tatiana Jones, and her wife, Pin Lee, played by Sabrina Wu, embark on a research expedition to an uninhabited planet with Murderbot in tow. Though Mensa says her team is not comfortable with the idea of a sentient construct being required to work for us, the company will not provide insurance for their research project unless the team takes security. Murderbot has little interest in Mensa and her weird crew. Still, it easily homes in on the team's subtle interpersonal dynamics, as when its pulse rate monitor identifies a love triangle between Pin Lee, Rothi, and Arada. It also quickly realizes that Dr. Garanthan, an augmented human whose brain can perform some computer functions, suspects that it might be rogue. The unit keeps one eye on the scientists and the other on its favorite soap opera, The Rise and Fall of Sanctuary Moon, which features a romance between a dashing captain, played by John Cho, and a beautiful navigation bot, played by Dawana Wise. But when Mensa discovers that another research team on the planet has been killed by unknown assailants, Murderbot is forced to engage with its helpless and useless clients. It may be a literally heartless machine, but Murderbot shares more in common with its clients than it's willing to admit. Like many humans, it is uncomfortable with sustained eye contact. It would rather take an acid bath than give a speech, and it prefers the company of TV characters to real people. Also, its co-workers drive it up a wall. Unfortunately, the Planetary Alliance gang insist on treating Murderbot like one of the team, inviting it to ride in their transport vehicle instead of the cargo bay where SecUnits usually travel, and giving it a crew uniform to wear when its armor is damaged. Murderbot's struggle to accept being embraced, figuratively and literally, by its human clients who insist on valuing its input and individuality, is the show's comedic engine. When Murderbot gets really desperate, it searches Sanctuary Moon and other TV shows for examples of small talk. Tell me, Dr. Arata, what planet are you from originally? Which it mimics with comical discomfort. For nearly 5 episodes, though, the Weitz brothers stall their lead character's development by relegating its emotional turmoil to excessive voiceovers. Murderbot's inner monologue can be funny. I don't have a stomach, so I can't throw up, but if I did, I would. But it also keeps the story in a holding pattern. Mensa and her team try to connect with Murderbot. It stonewalls them while stewing over how annoying they are. Repeat. The debut season of Murderbot is based on the first book in Wells' series, All Systems Red, which clocks in at about 150 pages. I mention this because the Apple TV Plus adaptation suffers from season-long pilot syndrome, a common malady which a new streaming series spends much of its initial 8 to 10 episodes restating its premise. The Weitz brothers, credited as the series' sole writers, hew close to Wells' source material for their adaptation, but there simply isn't enough story to fill 10 episodes, even at around 25 minutes each. As a result, the season is nearly half over before Murderbot's dynamic with its team and the ongoing mystery about the slaughtered researchers really start to develop. When Murderbot finally starts voicing its annoyance to Mensa and the team, the series gets a lot more entertaining. "I wish I didn't have to, but of course I can hear you," grouses SecUnit, after Pin Lee complains about its eavesdropping. "I'm a highly advanced piece of technology." Skarsgård, a stealth comedic presence in Succession, also puts his Nordic reserve to good use as Murderbot. The actor enhances his character's long inner monologues with his eloquent ice blue eyes, which can convey emotions ranging from disdain and discomfiture to despair and devotion. Dumiswene makes Mensa believable as both a thoughtful leader and an overly anxious empath prone to panic attacks. And Pen15's Anna Conkle drops in for an amusing turn as Libibi, a survivor from the other research team who can't stop speculating about Murderbot's anatomy. Viewers who stick with Murderbot will be rewarded with a moving finale, one that solidifies the character's relationship with SecUnit and seems to set up the story from Wells' second book, 2018's Artificial Condition. Apple TV Plus is yet to announce a renewal, but the streamer isn't opposed to giving expensive sci-fi series multiple seasons, so it's not unreasonable to believe that Skarsgård's restless robot will be back. Now that Murderbot finally found its voice, it deserves a chance to use it. The first 2 episodes of Murderbot premiered on Friday, May 16th on Apple TV+. That was Murderbot's review, Alexander Skarsgård's killer robot comedy is slow to boot up. It was by Kristen Baldwin, who's giving the show a grade of B- so far. From the movie review section, we have a couple reviews. They're both marked as spoiler alerts, but when I've read them, it doesn't seem like there's huge spoilers here. This Mission Impossible one looks to be about 7 minutes long, in case you need to turn the volume down just for a few minutes. Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning review. Tom Cruise's latest and last mission is equally baffling and awesome. Cruise and director Christopher McQuarrie saved the most ludicrous mission for last. This is by Jordan Hoffman. I lost count of the number of times someone told Tom Cruise that he was the one while watching Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, the 8th and probably last entry in the nearly 30-year run of movies based on the old 1960s television series. And considering how long he's played Ethan Hunt and how the words "a Tom Cruise production" light up the screen followed immediately by his name leading the cast, it's hard not to chuckle when so many say only he is the savior and only he can rescue humanity from the problems it has created. Then you remember that Cruise has been hanging from airplanes, flying his own helicopters, and soaring into the sky on motorcycles in a parade of increasingly shocking, "he's really doing that" stunts, and how the release of Top Gun Maverick really did bring theatrical movie going back from near death after COVID. If anyone deserves stoking the coals of their ego, he might be the guy. Which is why I sat in the IMAX theater and cheered every time the 62-year-old Cruise found a new excuse to appear in nothing but his tight navy blue boxer briefs. You work as hard as Tom does, you'll want to rip off that wetsuit and give us the close-up too. The same rules applied to the movie's cosmically convoluted script. The complex storyline is so inscrutable, it's almost charming. There are episodes of the old 80s cartoon show Voltron that make more sense, and those were poorly translated from Japanese with scenes removed to make it acceptable for children. The early scenes are bogged down, unfortunately, by a lot of recapping chatter. Don't worry if you get stuck in line buying Twizzlers. And none of it matters. All you need to know is that Cruise and his crew need to overcome insurmountable odds more than once to grab a thing or clip a thing or shove a thing into another thing at exactly the right moment. It's visual storytelling, and it's the same song the series has been singing since 1996 when Ethan Hunt dangled over a computer console showing off his core. You don't have to understand it to get it. But just for the record, the basic situation in The Final Reckoning is this. A malevolent AI program called The Entity is taking over cyberspace. And it's not just ruining search engine responses, it's planning to launch the world's nuclear missiles. Don't ask me why. If this was explained, I missed it. I was too busy laughing when the threat's origin was described as a primordial digital ooze, and its later manifestation as the Lord of Lies. Ethan, naturally, would prefer not to have the planet vaporized, but he can't work with any government. Like Frodo bringing the one true ring to Mount Doom, if anyone other than he were to harness the power of the entity, the lure to do something crazy with it would be too great. The phrase, "no nations," is used several times, which either means that Cruise wants to lead us all to a new world order, or Paramount Pictures means to salute the global market for the profitability of their blockbusters. Maybe both. To get the entity, Hunt has to retrieve it from a sunken Russian submarine. To accomplish this, his team, played by Haley Atwell, Simon Pegg, Palm Clementieff, and Greg Tarzan Davis, needs to send out a ping from somewhere in the Arctic, then retrieve Hunt from his dive. In the meantime, Hunt must convince the U.S. Armed Forces to get him there, via aircraft carrier, which involves a great deal of shirtlessness. The big set piece sends Cruise underwater, dodging torpedoes and holding his breath. I look forward to the actual physicians watching this sequence and finding a way to explain how Hunt survives the problems of deep water pressurization other than throwing their hands up and saying, "hey, he's Tom Cruise." The second big showstopper, as you may have seen in ads, involves Cruise getting thrown around like a ragdoll on a biplane. The phrase "thrill ride" gets used a lot when describing movies like this, but I will tell you that these scenes truly did make me gasp and feel a little sick to my stomach. Nauseating is hardly something they put on a poster, but believe me when I say it is the best possible compliment. Somehow, The Final Reckoning is 170 minutes, but like Tom Cruise running across Westminster Bridge, it zooms. Even the acres of baffling dialogue are delivered swiftly. There are frequent cuts to Angela Bassett as the President of the United States, barking at her department heads, including Holt McCallany and Nick Offerman. These terse scenes are shot in a lot of shallow focus close-ups with enormous computer banks with tape reels whirring in the background. It almost feels like a late nod to the series' TV origins and a rare case of an almost abstract stylistic move in these typically modern, sleek films. There's also the return of Issei Morales as the mustache-twirling villain whose motivation is as baffling as the entity itself. A great newcomer to the series is Tremel Tillman, who we know from Severance, as a cool guy submarine commander. Also, look for a surprisingly charming callback to the first film in the series with the reappearance of a key character that I don't think you'll see coming. Is The Final Reckoning truly final? Who can say? Yes, Ethan Hunt saves the day. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that this summer tentpole does not end in atomic annihilation. But not even his platitudes about fate and determination can eradicate villainy. Eventually, problems will arise. The thought that Ethan Hunt won't be there is simply impossible. That's the Mission Impossible review. The Final Reckoning, Tom Cruise's latest and last mission, is equally baffling and awesome. It was by Jordan Hoffman, who's giving the movie a grade of B. As a sidebar, we do have this article. Tremel Tillman thought Mission Impossible director wanted to talk Severance when he offered him the part. This is by Lauren Huff. Thank you for your service, Captain Milchuk. Severance star Tremel Tillman has an ace role in the upcoming Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, and it's all thanks to his unsettling role as former supervisor-turned-manager of the severed floor at Lumen Industries. So, I don't know if you know this, but Christopher McQuarrie is a big fan of Severance, Tillman tells Entertainment Weekly of his Final Reckoning director. When McQuarrie, who has been part of the Mission franchise in some way, shape, or form since 2011's Ghost Protocol, requested a Zoom meeting with Tillman, the actor firmly believed he was just calling to chat about the hit Apple TV Plus series. Instead, Tillman says he went on to talk about Mission Impossible, and he said there was a role in it for me. And I asked him, I said, well, what do we do from here? What's the deal? He said, you think about it, and if you want to take the role, it's yours. He continued, and I ended the meeting and I closed my laptop and I jumped up and down and ran around my apartment and called my team and I said, listen, I know that we're gearing up to film for season 2 of Severance, but we've got to figure this out. And I accepted the offer to come play in Mission Impossible. Praise Keir. In Final Reckoning, Tillman plays Captain Bledsoe, the enigmatic leader of a stealth U.S. submarine. Bledsoe and his crew are pivotal to Ethan Hunt, played by Tom Cruise's latest mission, in which he and the IMF team hope to take down the rogue AI cyberweapon known as the Entity once and for all. McQuarrie wasn't the only Severance enthusiast on set, though. Some members of Captain Bledsoe's crew were also fans of the show. Funny enough, in between takes, they would whisper, "We love Severance," and then go back to filming, the actor reveals. It's always a delight to be a part of a project that people respect and love the work. Unfortunately for those fans, the Final Reckoning role doesn't require him to utter such incredible phrases as devour feculents a la Seth Milchuk, but it does require him to rattle off naval terms with the confidence of someone who is at the top of their game. To help, there was a team of naval advisors on set. Any questions that we had, how to pronounce it, what they meant, they were on deck to teach us every step of the way, and I was so grateful for the instruction because I needed it. I had to sound like a guy who had done this for years, and so having their guidance was pivotal for me, Tillman says. One thing he didn't need guidance on, however, was stunts. Captain Bledsoe is pivotal to the story, but not so much to the film's action. Tillman says he was happy to leave all that to Cruise, though. No, I was kind of glad I didn't have stunts, he says. I was kind of glad to be the boss behind the controls and tell people what to do instead. That was good enough for me. Okay, no stunts, but what about one of those iconic Milchuk-approved dance parties? Bledsoe danced his commands, Tillman says with a laugh. That was a dance right there. That man is talented, and he does not play. Mission Impossible, The Final Reckoning, which also stars Hayley Atwell, Issa Morales, Ving Rhames, Simon Pegg, Palm, Clementieff, Henry Zernissi, Holt McKelley, Janet McTeer, Nick Offerman, Hannah Waddingham, Angela Bassett, Shay Wingham, and more, hits theaters May 23rd. That was Travel Tillman thought Mission Impossible director wanted to talk Severance when he offered him the part. And that was by Lauren Huff. We have one more review, and it's going to be a fun one to read. But before I do, I will remind everybody that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly, and I am reading from their website, which is EW.com. So our next movie review also has this spoiler alert warning. Hurry Up Tomorrow. The Weeknd's depiction of a mopey pop star is astonishingly boring. Jenna Ortega co-stars as an obsessed fan in co-writer and director Trey Edwards Schultz's lackluster drama. This is also by Jordan Huffman. More like Hurry Up and End. For the record, The Weeknd, also known as Abel Tesfaye, has released several songs that I think are terrific. He has a great ear for melody and a sensational voice. Blinding Lights, Starboy, and the few I've heard from his latest album are genuinely great. I'm saluting the man's talent loudly and clearly before I explain that Hurry Up Tomorrow, the confessional vanity film he co-wrote, co-produced, and stars in, is atrocious. The nearly plot-free movie is self-indulgent, overly serious, and, worst of all, just plain dull. It's all the more upsetting because his music can be so invigorating. How can someone who created those songs put out something as lifeless as this? It's not like a pop exploitation film needs to have a diamond-sharp screenplay like The Usual Suspects. Hell, A Hard Day's Night and Purple Rain are classics because they are super light on plot, heavy on music, and offer a stage to make the artists look really cool. Hurry Up Tomorrow ignores this formula and is a 105-minute exercise of being stuck with an annoying sad sack who happens to have written some songs you love. There is very little story in this movie, but the basic situation is this. Tesfaye is on tour, and he's miserable. He's broken up with a girl, and she won't pick up the phone. He cries and complains about it, then gets angry and violent. And his manager, played by Barry Keoghan, can only get him to perform by goading him with cocaine and telling him he's a superhero and not human. After the show, there's booze, girls, and hotel suites, but Abel's locked in the bathroom, being sad. Concurrent with this, we see Jenna Ortega. Her character's name is listed as Anima online, but I didn't catch it. Melodramatically burn down a house, get in her truck, and drive to see The Weeknd in concert in Los Angeles. And there she is, in the audience, making eye contact with Abel just when his anxiety levels hit the roof, forcing him to lose his voice. He cuts the show short, something that actually happened at SoFi Stadium in 2022, and dashes. Anima sneaks backstage and literally crashes into Abel. They join forces, escape, and share a pleasant evening at the Santa Monica Pier, featuring color-saturated lighting and shallow-focus lenses. Evading Keoghan, they go to a new hotel where Abel plays her a new song on his phone. She weeps and says it's as if his songs are about her. There's a fade-out. In the light of day, Abel realizes he has to get back to his real life. He must see his doctor, he must go to Australia to perform. He thanks Anima for a nice night, and she flips out. She turns violent and goes misery on him, eventually tying him to the bed in a Christ pose while she plays his old hits, analyzing them like Patrick Bateman and doing what I believe to be an intentionally silly dance. This is, by the way, pretty much the only sequence in the entire film with any life to it, and it comes almost at the end. Throughout their scenes, Abel blubbers and whimpers while Anima talks about safe spaces and being toxic. I half expected to get billed a copay for a therapy appointment. It's worth pointing out, though, that the only women in this entire movie are the unseen ex-girlfriend who sends Abel into a cursing rage, and then the groupie who goes bananas and explodes into violence. One wonders what the weekend's female audience will think of all this. In a way, I respect Tifai's sincerity, but he's not a good enough actor to pull this off. It's all just a little embarrassing. Hell, even Morrissey would watch this movie and tell him to touch grass. There are only two concert performance scenes in the movie, and director Trey Edward Schultz, whose first film, Krisha, was marvelous, but his later ones, like It Comes at Night and Waves, never quite delivered, shoots them in the least dynamic way. Abel stays in a medium close-up, and there's no choreography worth mentioning. The songs themselves are good. All the party scenes bet the ranch that crazy lighting will get the job done in lieu of anything dramatic. Ortega and Keoghan do their best with the paper-thin material, but there's a hollowness front and center of this film. I should report that the studio did not host press screenings for Hurry Up Tomorrow, so I attended a public preview marketed to the weekend fans. The movie was met with stone silence for most of the running time, eventually turning to derisive laughter. Bad movies come and go, but Hurry Up Tomorrow presents the weekend as so needy and so irritating that it may have lasting effects. The next time one of his songs comes up on a playlist, I may hit fast forward. I've spent enough time with this guy. That's the review for Hurry Up Tomorrow. The weekend's depiction of a mopey pop star is astonishingly boring. It was by Jordan Hoffman, who's giving the film a grade of D-. You don't get a grade that low very often. Those are always fun to read. Well, I mentioned high school prom season, and here is a list of 19 of the best high school proms in movie history, from She's All That to Carrie. From choreographed dances to total disaster, these are cinema's most memorable nights to remember. This is by Mary Solosi and James Mercadante. Prom is basically the Met Gala for high schoolers. Think about it. Everyone is dolled up to the nines, there's usually a random theme, and it's all one giant spectacle. Just look at the evolution of promposals. Hollywood has illustrated this rite of passage in every way possible, from sparks flying to climactic moments of truth to, well, literal flames. We're calling you out, Carrie. Ahead, Entertainment Weekly has picked 19 iconic prom movies showcasing film teens' most memorable nights to remember. The first item on our list is 10 Things I Hate About You from 1999. This ripped from Shakespeare teen movie follows the romantic exploits of sisters Kat, played by Julia Stiles, and Bianca, played by Larissa Olenek. In the prom scene at the very end, Kat's relationship with Patrick, played by Heath Ledger, is upset by the machinations of their high school's resident sleazebag, played by Andrew Keegan. Bianca's romance with Cameron, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, is solidified when she beats up said sleazebag on behalf of both Cameron and Kat. American Pie, also from 1999. When four high school friends vow to lose their virginities before graduation, prom night is certain to play an important role in their quest. The prom itself in American Pie is fairly anticlimactic as far as the completion of the boys' mission is concerned, and one of them, Jim, played by Jason Biggs, delivers an impassioned speech about how meaningless the whole enterprise was to begin with. At the after party, however, all four boys fulfill their pact. Back to the Future from 1985. Traveling all the way back to 1955, Marty McFly, played by Michael J. Fox, crashes his parents' first date and nearly erases himself from existence. To undo the damage, he has to make sure Mom and Dad seal the deal with a kiss at Hill Valley's Enchantment Under the Sea dance. So he grabs a guitar, joins the band to win the crowd with the Penguins' dreamy Earth Angel, and then gives the 50s a rock and roll preview with one of the most iconic renditions of Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Goode. Blockers is from 2018. This entire raunchy comedy centers around prom, so it's only natural that it's the best prom ever. The school-sponsored party is totally fine. There's a fancy photo booth, trendy balloon letters, P-R-O-M, and good music. But it's the after-parties that made us want to go back to high school, stat. It starts at a fellow student's lake house, one that also boasts a killer pool, with an after party at what has to be the most lenient hotel of all time. The school's seniors take over an entire floor, with the party taking up dozens and dozens of suites and even spilling out into the hallway. And yes, there are beer pongs aplenty. Carrie from 1976. While many of the prom scenes on the list are romantic finales to sweet teen comedies, Carrie takes a more disturbing approach. When Carrie, played by Sissy Spacek, an outcast with telekinetic abilities, is named prom queen by a rigged vote, she enjoys her moment of glory very briefly before she is drenched in pig's blood by the mean, popular girls who set her up to win. It doesn't end well for the bullies, or anyone else at the prom, for that matter. Did we mention Carrie has telekinetic abilities? Drive Me Crazy from 1999. This 1999 teen rom-com, named after the Britney Spears song, stars Melissa Joan Hart and Adrian Grenier as neighbors who pretend to date in order to make other people jealous. Their scheme works, but at the prom, where else, they realize they were meant for each other all along, and they ditch the dates they had worked so hard to win. Fast Times at Ridgemont High, 1982. Amy Heckerling's iconic 1982 movie, based on Cameron Crowe's nonfiction book of the same name, comes to an end with all its characters at the prom. Sean Penn's stoner Jeff Spicoli is delayed by an impromptu lesson from his arch-nemesis, history teacher Mr. Hand, played by Ray Walston, but he arrives at the dance just in time to deliver an energetic performance of Woolly Bully. Footloose from 1984, when Ren McCormick, played by Kevin Bacon, moves from Chicago to the small town of Beaumont. He learns that dancing and rock and roll have been outlawed there since a fatal crash killed the local reverend's son. Ren and some of his new pro-dancing friends arrange for a prom just outside the city limits, and they all bust a move to Kenny Loggins' iconic title track. High School Musical 3, Senior Year. The prom scene in the third and final High School Musical movie takes the form of a musical number performed as part of an East High drama production about the Wildcats' senior year. The song, A Night to Remember, takes Troy, played by Zac Efron, Gabriella, played by Vanessa Hudgens, and their friends from picking out their outfits all the way to the prom. Jennifer's Body from 2009. Devil's Kettle High's spring formal sorta sucked for Needy Lisinski, played by Amanda Seyfried. Her boyfriend, Johnny Simmons, cheats on her with her best friend, Jennifer, played by Megan Fox, who ends up eating him alive. Plus, the band who set this whole disaster in motion is on stage performing their ubiquitous one-hit wonder. Though Needy gets to take matters into her own hands, it only lands her in a psychiatric unit. Not exactly a Cinderella story, but it makes for a killer popcorn climax. Lady Bird from 2017. Prom is a turning point for Lady Bird, played by Saoirse Ronan. While dress shopping with her hypercritical mother, Marion, played by Laurie Metcalf, the pink-haired teen finds the dress, and with it, a painful epiphany. Her mom loves her, but doesn't like her. But on prom night, Lady Bird surrounds herself with people who actually enjoy her company. Instead of skipping prom with her too cool for the Dave Matthews Band date, played by Timothy Chalamet, and his judgmental clique, she heads straight to her best friend Julie's, that's Beanie Feldstein's house. Together, they patch things up and restart the evening as each other's dates, dancing the night away under the hawk-eyed gaze of a nun chaperone while Crash Into Me plays. Mean Girls from 2004. Katie Heron, played by Lindsay Lohan, shows up late to the spring fling dance because she was busy winning a mathletes competition, but she arrives just in time to be named Spring Fling Queen. In a memorable acceptance speech, she breaks up the crown she's been given and tosses the pieces to different students in attendance, saying they all look beautiful and reminding them what an empty honor the tiara really represents. It's just plastic, after all. Napoleon Dynamite from 2004. We all need a friend like Pedro, played by Efren Ramirez. When Napoleon, played by John Hader, gets ditched at the school dance by popular girl Trisha, played by Emily Kinnard, his buddy gives him the green light to pair up with his date, Deb, played by Tina Majorino, for a dance. Thanks to Pedro, we got the most awkward two-step shuffle and one of the film's many quotable gems. I like your sleeves. They're real big. Never Been Kissed, also from 1999. That was a big year for prom movies. Drew Barrymore stars in this teen rom-com as Josie Geller, a copy editor who goes undercover at a local high school to report on the truth of what's going on in the lives of teenagers. The former geek goes to the prom, the theme of which is famous historical couples, dressed as Rosalind from As You Like It, and is elected prom queen only to reject the title and confess her deception in a dramatic, tearful speech. Pretty in Pink from 1986. John Hughes's class-conscious romance sees Wrong Side of the Tracks Andy, played by Molly Ringwald, fall for Blaine, played by Andrew McCarthy, a preppy rich kid whose cruel friends sabotage their relationship. After first deciding to skip the prom, Andy sews together two hand-me-down pink dresses for the fashion statement of her wildest prom dreams and goes to the dance to show them they didn't break me. Walking in on the arm of her best friend Ducky, played by John Cryer, she shows them all right and wins Blaine back too. Prom from 2011. This 2011 ensemble teen movie revolves around the prom as Nova, played by Amy Teargarden, and her friends make decorations as part of the planning committee, debate what to wear, and obsess over whether their crushes will ask them to the dance. Despite her father's initial disapproval of Jesse, played by Tom McDonnell, a bad boy with a heart of gold, Nova goes to the prom with him, and all the drama leading up to the dance proves worth it in the end. Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion from 1997. Prom with a date just doesn't hit the same as showing up with your best friend. Romy, played by Mira Sorvino, and Michelle, played by Lisa Kudrow, joined at the hip, per usual, strut into prom together in 80s Madonna-inspired fashions, finding their own little corner to trade snarky play-by-plays on their so unhip peers. Since it's the last night of their senior year, Romy makes the move to ask the prom king, played by Vincent Ventresca, for one dance. He agrees, but cruelly leaves her hanging until the night's swan song, Cyndi Lauper's Time After Time. But don't worry, they get the last laugh when they reclaim that soured anthem in a campy, fantastical performance at their 10-year high school reunion. She's All That from 1999. This high school set, Pygmalion, ends with the prom. The artsy, eccentric, turned popular girl Lainey, played by Rachel Lee Cook, attends the dance with the wrong guy, played by Paul Walker, having fallen out with Zach, played by Freddie Prinze Jr., the big man on campus who gave her a prom queen-worthy makeover. When Zach finds out that Lainey's date is planning to seduce her after the dance, he tries to put a stop to it, but luckily, Lainey doesn't need any help fighting him off. After she deafens her date with an air horn, Lainey and Zach reconcile and dance alone in her backyard. Twilight from 2008 is our last entry. The first installment in the wildly popular Twilight saga ends with a romantic prom scene. Shy, awkward, and clumsy Bella, played by Kristen Stewart, has her foot in a cast and is not thrilled to be at the dance, but her vampire beau, Edward, played by Robert Pattinson, insists that she would regret missing it. They dance to Iron and Wine as the vengeful vampire Victoria, played by Rachel Lefevre, unbeknownst to either of them, watches. That was kind of fun. That was the 19 of the best high school proms in movie history, from She's All That to Carrie. It was by Mary Solosi and James Mercadante. It's not Golden Globes time yet, but here's an article that says the Golden Globes announced bizarre new Best Podcast category for its Film and TV Awards show. The organization announced that it will honor the best podcasts of the year at the 2026 Golden Globes, hosted by returning MC Nikki Glaser. This is by Joey Nolfi. The Golden Globes announced a strange new development amid the group's evolving identity on the awards circuit with the implementation of a new Best Podcast competitive category. Beginning at January's 2026 Golden Globe ceremony, the organization will recognize the best podcasts of the year among its awards slate, citing extraordinary and diverse talents in podcasting and seismic growth in the podcasting space as justification for adding the category to its film and TV-centric show. As the world of entertainment continues to evolve, we are excited to recognize new forms of storytelling, said the Globe's president Helen Haney in a press statement. She added that podcasts have emerged as a profound medium for sharing narratives and building communities across global borders and generations, and that the inclusion of a new category expands the Golden Globe's ability to recognize new narrative outlets. Haney finished her statement by stressing that by celebrating achievements in both audio and visual podcasts, we aim to honor our heritage categories while making room for new voices and formats to be heard. The Golden Globe's announcement elaborated further on the new competitive categories nomination process, which will involve highlighting the top 25 podcasts that qualify for the award, with 6 advancing to the final nomination slots for the category. Eligibility requirements and more details on the nomination process for Best New Podcast will be announced in the near future, the Globes confirmed. Elsewhere, the Golden Globes recently announced that 2025 ceremony host Nikki Glaser would return to MC the 2026 edition, following a well-received performance as the head of the telecast. The Golden Globes have long established a reputation for favoring starry A-lister projects on the awards trail, and the podcasting space now boasts a wealth of celebrity projects hosted by famous stars, with everyone from Michelle Obama to Kelly Ripa, Bowen Yang, and Dax Shepard fronting popular shows on their platforms. The Golden Globes' new category follows a trend for major awards bodies that have announced new competitive brackets, including the Oscars, which recently announced that it would implement new categories for stunts and casting at future ceremonies. The 2026 Golden Globes airs Sunday, January 11th. That was Golden Globes announced bizarre new Best Podcast category for its film and TV awards show, and it was by Joey Nolfi. Also, as a twist, Mac's streaming app will be called HBO Max once again. The plot twist everyone's been waiting for. Wait, is this the early 2020s? This is by Nick Romano. Warner Brothers Discovery announced during Wednesday's upfront presentations that its big streaming app, Max, will be rebranded once again, and it's a name we're all familiar with. "It's the plot twist everyone's been waiting for," reads a cheeky ad that can be seen on the service. Max is becoming HBO Max. Yes, Max will revert to its previous name starting this summer, and at least the powers that be are having some self-aware fun at this latest move. The powerful growth we have seen in our global streaming service is built around the quality of our programming. Today, we are bringing back HBO, the brand that represents the highest quality in media, to further accelerate that growth in the years ahead, David Zaslav, the CEO and president of Warner Brothers Discovery, said in a statement shared via press release. On a recent podcast episode of The Town, hosted by Puck's Matthew Belloni, Casey Bloys, the head of HBO and Max Content, made an offhand joke that spoke volumes. "Do you know how much hair I've lost worrying about just HBO and Max and what to call it?" In one of his many moves after the big Warner Media Discovery merger in 2022, Zaslav rebranded the HBO Max streaming platform simply as Max in an effort to merge Discovery's programming with Warner Brothers and HBO's library of titles. In the years since, however, subscriber interest in many of the Discovery programming has dwindled. What people were not engaging as much with was the food content, the home content, and some of the TLC programming. That is, not the big franchises, Bloys said on The Town. "We've already seen in recent weeks the logo for Max change to a logo design that's way more reminiscent of the HBO look, and this latest name change suggests the company is working to really lean on the prestige of the HBO brand, i.e., what the subscribers seem to want. We will continue to focus on what makes us unique, Not everything for everyone in a household, but something distinct and great for adults and families, J.B. Peretti, the president and CEO of streaming at Warner Brothers Discovery, said at the upfronts. It's really not subjective, not even controversial. Our programming just hits different. Blois added, with the course we are on and strong momentum we are enjoying, we believe HBO Max far better represents our current consumer proposition. And it clearly states our implicit promise to deliver content that is recognized as unique and, to steal a line we always said at HBO, worth paying for. That was Max's streaming app will be called HBO Max once again, the plot twist everyone's been waiting for. That was by Nick Romano. And that takes us to the end of all the time we have for Entertainment Weekly this week. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, which is EW.com. Come back next week to hear if we've got new reviews that will be equally fun to read, and maybe some other lists, but we'll just have to stay tuned to see what's online. Until then, thanks for listening. Goodbye.